Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The economic impact of the COVID pandemic has been devastating. The Labor Department announced that more than 1.5 million Americans filed new state unemployment claims last week. That number raised the 12-week total to 44 million people. The additional $600 a week in unemployment benefits on top of what people get from the state will end next month unless Congress acts. Politicians said that $2.3 trillion pandemic relief package known as the CARES Act was supposed to help people who lost their jobs and small business owners. But according to investigations, it benefited corporations and the rich instead of the working class. In a recent piece for The Intercept and The American Prospect, one of today's guests, Dave Dayan, writes, "Since the CARES Act became law, the investor class has never looked back. While Americans struggle to file unemployment claims and extract stimulus checks from their banks, while small businesses face extinction and a meager and underbaked federal grant program, the Fed has, at least temporarily, propped up every equity and credit market in the country. And in a testament to its strength, it did so without spending a single cent." David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect. His work has appeared in many publications, including The New Republic and The LA Times. His first book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, won the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for joining us. In another piece for ProPublica, Jesse Eisinger writes that shares of private equity firms are soaring. The reason? Asset holders like Apollo and Blackstone have been insured by the world's most powerful central bank. This largesse is boundless and without conditions. Even if a second wave of outbreaks were to occur, JP Morgan economists wrote in a note on Friday, the Fed has explicitly indicated that there is no dollar limit and no danger of running out of ammunition. Jesse Eisinger is an award-winning reporter and editor at ProPublica. He is the author of The Chicken S Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. In 2011, Jesse won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for a series of stories on questionable Wall Street practices. Hi, Jesse. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me back, Rose.
Well, great to have both of you. Let's first start off and talk about where we are today when it comes to workers. We just got these numbers from the Labor Department. 1.5 million people filed new unemployment claims last month. That number raised the 12-week total to a whopping 44 million people. First off, Jesse, it's important to point out that 40% of low-income Americans lost their jobs due to the pandemic. That is a huge number.
Absolutely. And numbers that we haven't seen even worse than the Great Depression, certainly for the speed with which they lost those jobs. We should concede and point out that the stimulus checks and the extended unemployment benefits and increased unemployment benefits are significant. And have gone some way to mitigate the pain of these extraordinary job losses. But it's nothing compared to what the Fed has done. You know, that's sort of the congressional portion of this and the fiscal portion of this. The Fed is the monetary portion of this, and they have done much more, spent much more, been much more efficient. Have really helped out to a greater extent. The key here is that the aid to workers has conditions, and most importantly, is temporary. And as you pointed out in your introduction, it's going to run out without congressional congressional extensions, which are unlikely to happen.
We should also point out, Dave, we've been covering unemployment benefits for a couple months now, and we're still getting emails from listeners who are having a hard time getting into California's unemployment website because it's just out of date. according to an analysis by One Fair Wage, when you're talking about restaurant workers, for example, only 56% of those who applied for unemployment are receiving benefits. So 44% have either been denied or are still waiting. Here we are in mid-June, and a lot of people are still not getting these benefits.
Yeah, and you can add to that reporting that was done in the Huffington Post today that as many as 35 million Americans who were eligible for the $1,200 one-time stimulus checks have not received them. So, I mean, I think in general, the dichotomy here is that individual relief and to some extent even small business relief is, you know, follows along these rickety chains where it's difficult to actually obtain the money. Or it can be an elongated process, and it's also temporary, and there's some question as to whether it will be renewed. Whereas you look at the large corporate side and the investor side of the equation, and the Federal Reserve just had to sort of nod in the direction of those markets, and they were able to soar. Albeit they are coming back a little bit to earth today as the investor class realizes that the rest of the economy was not rescued to the degree that they were, and suddenly this dawning has occurred today, and the Dow is down about 1,400 points at the moment.
And before we talk about the Fed, I also just want to mention that according to Pew, Hispanic women and immigrants got hit so hard, harder than most people, because of COVID. And it's so important to talk about immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, because they have not been able to get unemployment. They have not been able to access those $1,200 checks. In California, they were able to access only $500, and there was so much demand that so many people didn't get it. So, Jesse, when we're talking about bailouts and who's getting it, it's so important to mention immigrants, and according to Pew, particularly Hispanic women have been hit so hard by COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And in general, that's true, and low-income people are particularly hurt by this. One bizarre aspect of this, and we Dave talked about the rickety machinery here and the rickety channels. The poor were likely not to get stimulus checks or to get them very, very late because they often don't file taxes. And they often file taxes through tax prep companies that have set up in this kind of bizarre way separate bank accounts for them, and the IRS, to the extent that it sent low-income people stimulus checks, sometimes it would send them to these new third-party banks that people didn't have accounts at but had been set up temporarily by exploitative tax prep companies. So what the key here, what Dave was pointing out, and what I think is the really essential point here, is that help for individuals either didn't come or was temporary or came with kind of conditions. On small businesses, it came with significant conditions. Help for large corporations, and even large corporations with an enormous amount of debt that had been highly speculative, that are owned by the wealthiest and most risk-seeking investors, that came with no conditions and was unlimited. You know, we can get into the details here, but that's really the take-home here, is that average people did not get help in an efficient way. And there was a model, and we can get into this too, there was a model available to us that would have helped average people very efficiently, and that would be to underwrite their income at maybe not 100%, but at 80%, let's say. That's what most European countries did. And it seems to be working much better, and they have much lower increases in unemployment. And that's important because even when you help people with unemployment checks and stimulus checks, severing people from their jobs is going to have long-term negative consequences for them and for the economy. So we could really have tried to avoid this, but we didn't. And so we're setting ourselves up for significant problems down the road.
To your knowledge, Jesse, did anyone in Congress want to go that route?
I don't think it was ever seriously considered by the Democrats. The Democrats won what they considered to be some concessions here by extending unemployment and getting oversight, quote unquote, for the bailout, which Dave points out in the piece today, was really phantom oversight. Those were kind of the concessions that they won, and they had they perceived themselves as having very little leverage and very little bargaining power. And when McConnell realized that the Democrats thought this way and Schumer thought this way, basically my interpretation is he rolled them on almost everything. One of the big things that the Democrats wanted in some eventual future phase was help for desperate cities and local municipalities that are facing giant, spectacular, dangerous budget deficits. And the Democrats thought that they could come back and get that, and that Mitch McConnell might see the light and see the wisdom of helping states and localities out in a future phase. And they didn't hold out for that initially. And then McConnell has said, go pound sand. So the Democrats kind of did not seek to underwrite incomes in any significant way, and basically didn't get much of what ideally they should have thought, I think.
Mm-hmm. Dave, do you have anything to add to that point?
Yeah, I mean, there is a bill, I should say, that does do paycheck support that Pramila Jayapal put out, tried to get into the Democrats' most recent proposal in the House as an update for more pandemic relief, and Nancy Pelosi did not put that in the bill. On the Senate side, a wide breadth of the caucus, from Bernie Sanders to Doug Jones, the Democrat from Alabama, have all supported that concept. So there is support for it. There's kind of an interesting debate about whether this enhanced unemployment that adds $600 a week into everyone's paychecks, and for people in low-wage jobs, actually gives them a replacement rate of wages well above what they are making right now, whether that is a better idea in terms of giving workers more bargaining power to dictate better terms for their employment, because many of the jobs that have been lost were actually not very good jobs, and whether that was better than payroll support. But what we definitely know is that the unemployment boost is running out on July 31st, and we don't. It's certainly clear that everyone who wants a job is not going to be able to get one, but to any degree, by July 31st. In fact, there will be tens of millions of people out of work relative to the pre-pandemic baseline by July 31st. And so the real problem here is the temporary nature of it, and the fact that it wasn't triggered to the state of the economy, which is another thing that could have been done. Put in the technical term is automatic stabilizers that say, okay, if unemployment is above a certain level in a certain state, we're going to kick this in. Or if, you know, the economic situation is above a certain level, we're going to keep this payroll support going. Those would have been superior measures to what was done now, which is time limited and temporary, and seemingly is going to run out before the need dissipates.
Jesse, what are you hearing on Capitol Hill? What is Congress going to do once this money runs out?
Oh, you know, maybe Dave knows more about this than I. I haven't actually been reporting on this, the latest machination,
I can speak to that a little bit. So this week, the Senate Finance Committee had a hearing with the Labor Secretary, Eugene Scalia, who's actually Antonin Scalia's son. Republicans are saying that the enhanced unemployment creates a disincentive to work. At the same time, they're touting the May jobs report, which added 2.5 million jobs, which happened while these unemployment provisions were in place. So there's a contradiction there. It doesn't make any sense that this is stopping people from going back to their jobs if they're going back to their jobs by the millions. And nobody on the Republican side is talking about the fact that these supports are going to need to be in place. Now, Secretary Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, spoke yesterday in front of the Senate and said there may be some need for more economic stimulus. However, I think the way that he's thinking about it is like coupons for restaurants and travel, or the payroll tax cut that Trump wants, which helps people with jobs but not people without. These are not effective or adequate forms of stimulus for an economy that's still going to be at catastrophically bad levels by the time this all runs out. We had 1.5 million people file first-time unemployment claims last week. That is two times as many as any point in the history of that survey before the pandemic. So, you know, we had at the height 6 million people filing for first-time claims, but even 1.5 million would have been unthinkable before this pandemic, and that represents the lowest level in 10 weeks. So this is a significant problem, and I don't think that Congress is looking at this with the with the urgency that's needed, especially since they're waving around this May jobs report as if everything has been solved.
And currently, there's still so much need out there. We saw the video of very, very long lines outside of food banks. In fact, yesterday on social media, the Latino Task Force posted a photo in the Mission in San Francisco. On Friday, the line to get food was 13 blocks long. They provided two grocery boxes to over 1,800 families. So the need out there is still just so great. Today on Your Call, we are talking about how the stimulus money was doled out, who really benefited from the stimulus bills that we've heard so much about over the last couple of months. David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect. Jesse Eisinger is an editor at ProPublica, and they are both out with in-depth investigations looking at how the majority of the benefits went to corporations and the wealthy, not the working class. If you have any questions for David or Jesse, we'd love to hear from you. How are you affected by COVID now that we're many months in? What's your experience been like trying to get unemployment if you're a small business owner? What has your experience been like? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's spend a little time getting an update on what small businesses are currently dealing with. We did a lot of shows about what's called the Paycheck Protection Program, which gave a maximum of $10 million in loans to small businesses. It very quickly ran out of money. A lot of small businesses, especially sole proprietors, had a really hard time navigating the system. So here we are in June. Many small businesses face going out of business. And, you know, even when businesses return, it's important to note that they're going to get maybe less than half of the clientele that they got before COVID. So, Jesse, what updates can you give us about small businesses?
Well, there was a program, the Paycheck Protection Program, that was meant to help small businesses. And it was it had a first round that was highly criticized, but it probably was a modest success in keeping many small businesses afloat. It was criticized because some high-profile companies like Shake Shack and Ruth Chris got loans and other dubious entities that didn't appear to need it got loans. But it quickly ran out. It probably wasn't as big. It was clearly not as big as it should have been. And then a second round came But the second round, which was about $350 billion, there's still now over $130 billion of loans that haven't been made as of just recently, which is odd. It means that there's some problem with the banks putting these out. And one of the criticisms initially of the initial round was that it was done through the banks. We did this through the Small Business Administration, which then had to go through the banks. There could have been other mechanisms to do this kind of help and aid, like, say, the IRS. Instead, we did it through the SBA, which did it through the banks, and banks tended to favor their own customers. And now the second round is trying to correct for that, but it's not as successful. So it's been a kind of mixed success, I would say, here. Again, one of these things where the large corporations got kind of unlimited help in an extraordinarily successful way, save for today, when people are starting to wake up, as Dave said, while individuals and small businesses got loans and help that, in this case, the loans were had a lot of onerous conditions that some small businesses couldn't meet or didn't want to meet or couldn't successfully execute because of the unemployment benefits preventing them from bringing employees back. And so you see a mixed picture there.
Yeah. Can I add to that?
Please.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really interesting that the second round of the PPP has, you know, not gotten out the door months after it was put into place. And I think there are a few things going on here. One is that because of the initial requirement that 75% of that money had to be spent on worker payrolls, the program just didn't make sense in a lot of places that have high rents, like San Francisco, like New York, like Los Angeles. If a business had high rent, then they could only spend a quarter of that loan money, forgivable loan money, on rent and those types of other responsibilities, then the money wasn't going to help them. They were going to have to you know, forestall rent or go out of business anyway. So that was a big problem. Now, Congress then changed that. They extended the amount of time that it had to be spent out, and they lowered the burden a little bit from 75% to 60%, but then this runs up against the second problem. The PPP was structured so that it provided essentially bridge loan support for 8 weeks of payroll. 8 weeks of payroll. So we started with this crisis in March. We are well beyond 8 weeks from that time, and the crisis in terms of economic demand is still with us and is going to be with us for some time. So a small business, as you said, Rose, that expects 25, 50% of its capacity is simply not going to be helped by something that encompasses only 8 weeks of support. And so I think a lot of businesses either A, figured out the PPP wasn't going to help them very much, just sort of get them through a couple pay cycles, and then they were going to have to close up shop anyway, or B, they weren't even able to get the money in time for them to go through their very meager reserves, because small businesses don't have, like, tons of money in reserve in case of a pandemic. And they already went out of business. We've seen at least 100,000 small businesses go under already, and that's probably a very low number. That estimate was back in April. So I think that the program, as it was designed, was not equipped to handle the breadth of the pandemic that we saw, and not equipped to handle the particular circumstances of certain small businesses, and generally, as we've been saying on the show, not the kind of unlimited, unparalleled support that large corporations and investors got.
I'm going to ask one question before we go to break. Lee just wrote in, is there any awareness of how the difficulty of qualifying for unemployment has impacted seniors? A large percentage of seniors work part-time jobs to make ends meet. This is a great question. I haven't read much about this. Do you know, Jesse or Dave?
I mean, I'll say that the new unemployment provisions that were put in by the CARES Act were supposed to be much more encompassing in terms of people who work part-time were eligible. People who work gig employee jobs like Uber or Lyft were supposed to be eligible. However, this is being done on a state-by-state basis, and the program that allows that, called Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, has been rolled out very piecemeal, and some states still have not implemented that, so that if you were a freelancer or an independent contractor or a Uber or Lyft driver or a part-time worker, including a senior, in particular states, that program still isn't up and running, and you still haven't gotten the support that Congress said that you were entitled to.
Anything to add, Jesse?
No, I think it was a good summary. I think that this has been, in general, a harrowing economic time for the people who are the least solidly connected to the business, to employment, which, of course, the American economy has been shifting to away from solid employment and toward kind of temporary gig contracting employment for a while, and that particularly affects, this is not the kind of idyllic gig worker economy where you are freelancing and you get to sell your labor to the highest bidder and lots of companies are clamoring to pay more and more for you. The reality is that you have very little bargaining power and few benefits and few connections to regular employment, and your employment is tenuous. I think this affects the low-income workers and seniors as well, and in particular. So I think that it stands to reason that seniors who are doing part-time work would be very hurt by the economy right now.
Yeah, thank you for the email, Lee. I just found a piece over at Seattle PI. According to the Labor Bureau, the unemployment rate for seniors skyrocketed to 13.6% in April, almost five times greater than the 2.6% rate reported in February before COVID. And there is an amazing piece in the Washington Post by Ray Suarez. You all know him as a host of NPR, host of PBS. He said that he is having such a hard time with his funds that he had to get rid of his dental insurance. I mean, this is a very well-known journalist, and we're going to have Ray on to talk about just how difficult it is for people over 55, over 60 to really make ends meet. Someone who has such an amazing skills is suffering, someone like Ray Suarez. I think that says a lot about where we are today. We're going to break. We're speaking with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect. Jesse Eisinger is an award-winning editor at ProPublica. And coming up after a break, we will get into detail about their investigations. The Fed bailed out corporations and the rich, but as we're hearing, there's not that much relief for the working class. What will it take to change this? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be talking about budget deficits facing states across the country. California is facing a $54 billion budget deficit. Governor Gavin Newsom is proposing billions in cuts to education, healthcare, and other social services if the state does not receive a federal bailout. We will also talk about the power of police unions. That is tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about who really benefited from the bailouts and the relief packages. David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect. He's got an investigation up. You can read it at yourcallradio.org. He's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Jesse Eisinger is an award-winning reporter and editor at ProPublica. We also have his piece up. He is the author of The Chicken S Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. So let's dive in and talk about your pieces. Dave, the piece that you wrote for The Intercept and The American Prospect, it says, on March 23rd, the Federal Reserve announced it would start direct purchase of corporate debt, an unprecedented rescue of corporate America. Can you tell us how this actually works?
Sure. So the Fed set up two credit facilities, that's what they're called, and really they're just sort of banks. And what they're primed for lending, and the sort of deposits in those banks are made by the Treasury Department. And the CARES Act allowed $454 billion to be used as essentially deposits for those banks. And considering that the Federal Reserve typically, you know, lends out at a 10-to-1 rate for what they can lose through that deposit base, you're talking about $4.5 trillion that the Fed has at its disposal to lend. And there, two of the facilities they set up were the so-called primary market corporate credit facility and the secondary market. And all that means is that primary market would mean they would buy debt from corporations directly. So corporations issue a bond. They say, this is the way we want to borrow money. And the Federal Reserve buys it. Then there's the secondary market, which is the bond's already been issued, and the Fed buys it off of a whoever has it, whoever initially purchased it, or they buy shares in what are called exchange-traded funds, which are these investment funds that hold corporate debt. So the Fed hasn't done a whole lot of this. That's one of the points of my story, is that they've made these announcements, but the announcements were intended to signal to the credit markets that they were willing to do absolutely whatever it takes to protect these assets from falling in value. And it had its intended effect. If you look at March 23rd, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone up, even after today's losses, over 7,000 points. Since that point, the corporate bond buying, the market was sort of stalled out. People didn't want to issue lending to corporations in the private markets. But when the Fed said, "Well, we'll buy everything. Don't worry about it," all of a sudden those ramped up again. And there's been $1 trillion between January and May of corporate debt that's been issued. Last year, in all of last year, there was only a little over $1 trillion. So that market has absolutely surged. And the cost of borrowing money for corporations, what is known as the spread, has gone down. So it's now cheaper for corporations to borrow because the Fed said it would backstop that entire market. So these are like implicit subsidies that the Fed, through its announcements, has given to large corporations and investors that are worth trillions and trillions of dollars. And this comes before the Fed expends even one penny of the money that they have promised to spend.
Jesse, this is a point you also make in your piece called The Bailout is Working for the Rich. You write, for almost 100 years, the Fed purchased only government bonds. Now it announced a wide variety of programs to buy various forms of corporate and other debt. So why did the Fed make this decision?
Yeah, well, you know, we throw around the word in a colloquial sense, unprecedented, but this is literally unprecedented. The Fed has never done this before. You know, there's no going back from this kind of explicit support for corporations. Investors now are going to learn that the Fed is there for them. So why did it do it? Well, there were kind of two phases of the crisis. And the Fed faced both of these and decided to take extraordinary action for both phases. One was what's known as a kind of liquidity phase. Liquidity is a jargony term for how willing people are to buy or sell, to trade on markets, to lend to each other. And markets seized up, and there was truly a crisis as investors and everybody grappled with the extent of coronavirus and how many people were going to die, what the effects this was going to be, the effect this was going to have on the global economy and the economy in the United States. And people panicked, and the Fed stepped in. And this is a necessary and important role that the Fed has. And we can debate whether the Fed should have stepped in the way it stepped in. But largely, I think, and I think Dave thinks as well, I don't want to speak for him, that this was right and proper to do so, and it did in a very aggressive way. I think, unfortunately, it had to step into markets that it had to bail out in 2008. And what happened in the intervening time was we were supposed to fix a lot of these problems, to have these markets properly overseen by regulators and properly supported by investors through capital and things like that, so that some of these corners of the markets that were relatively unregulated going into the 2008 crisis were going to be fixed. They weren't, and the Fed had to bail them out again. But again, as I say, this liquidity issue was right and proper. The second issue was that the Fed decided, well, now we have to support corporate America through the crisis, do more than just help ensure that people are trading willingly, but actually say we're going to buy when assets fall to precipitous levels. We're going to stop the collapse in assets. And we're not going to just stop the collapse in assets of good and solid companies that would otherwise be completely healthy but for coronavirus. Again, there's a legitimate role here for the Fed to say, you know, coronavirus was completely unforeseeable, and people are absolutely panicked. We're going to be clear-headed, and we're going to provide support so that good and healthy companies can get through this. They didn't just say that. What the Fed said is, we're going to buy everything, good, bad, risky, not risky, junk-rated companies, we're going to buy you too. We're going to buy everything. We're going to buy Carnival Cruises, and we're going to buy the riskiest types, most exploitative business models, the ones that ran up the huge amounts of debt, the ones that bought back stock in recent years and didn't save for a rainy day, the ones that are owned. And this is one of the major points here, the ones that are owned by the most risk-seeking investors, the ones that need the highest returns, so they take the riskiest bets, like private equity companies, like Blackstone and Carlyle and Apollo. And so what the Fed was doing was ensuring, essentially, the richest, wealthiest, most risk-seeking investing class in America. And that's what really troubles me.
And to get specific, you named a few industries, but Dave, in your piece, you found that at least 49 large companies issued corporate bonds since the Fed announced it would purchase them. You write that Delta Airlines managed a $5 billion bond issue despite few flights in the air. Southwest raised $6 billion. Norwegian Cruise Line secured $2.2 billion. Six Flags, a shutter due to lockdowns, got $725 million. despite housing few travelers, Airbnb took $1 billion. The list goes on and on. Dave, can you, for people who don't understand this, because the fact is we don't really talk much about the Fed in the media, and a lot of people don't know how it works. I mean, I'm just wondering, where is all this money coming from? But let's just take Airbnb. So talk about how that worked. How did the Fed bail out Airbnb?
Right. So this is all happening sort of in an indirect format, because the Fed actually hasn't used the money. They've just sort of signaled that they're willing to. And I think I'll go back to Carnival, because it's a very good indication of how this works. So Carnival Cruises was obviously doesn't have any income or revenue at this point. They were struggling to figure out whether they could stay in business. And a bunch of hedge funds said, okay, well, we will lend to you but we'll give you a very high rate. And if you default, we'll take the company. I believe the rate of interest was 15% on the loan that they were willing to give. So the Fed then makes its announcement on March 23rd. We're going to buy corporate debt. We're going to buy all kinds of corporate debt, junk debt, whatever. And all of a sudden, the regular normal credit markets say, okay, Carnival Cruises, we will lend to you at 11%. So, and that was a portion of it. Some other part of it, they actually lent at 5%. So that spread, that difference between what hedge funds were willing to give in terms of the cost of borrowing to Carnival and what the markets that were reopened when the Fed put its announcement in place, that's a tangible amount. That's less money that Carnival has to give out to their creditors. So that's tangible there. And again, as Jesse said, this was a pandemic. Nobody could have planned for it. It's well and proper for the Fed to operate as the sort of lender of last resort, backstopping, when nobody else is willing to lend, the Fed will lend. In this case, they just said they would, and that reopened the market. But here's the problem. There are no conditions attached to what is being done with this money. So we know that, for example, Boeing took $25 billion in corporate debt from private investors and then fired 16,000 people at its plant. General Electric also took billions of dollars, fired 13,000 people. There's no sort of condition for what the money gets used for in terms of dividends or buybacks. Apple, when it made a large corporate bond issuance, said that we're going to use some of this money to buy back our stock. And so when you run these things through these private markets, first of all, the distributional analysis is different, because the corporate bond markets are available to large corporations, and so that's who gets the support. But the second thing is that the whole point of this bailout was to protect ordinary workers and make sure that whatever money was being expended actually went to stabilizing workers in the economy. Now it's being run through private credit markets, where the money can really go towards anything, mergers and acquisitions or dividends out to investors, and there's no condition that workers have to be protected. So that's, I think, some of the problems that arise when you run a bailout in this way. And let's be clear, the problem is not with the Fed. The problem is with Congress. Congress made the decision to run this bailout through the monetary engine, the Federal Reserve, and did not provide the same level of support to individuals and small businesses. That's the entire problem in a nutshell. One class got rescued, and the rest of us didn't.
Right. Before we go into that, Jesse, is there another way you can explain this simply, kind of a Fed bailout 101 and how this works for those of us who are still trying to wrap our heads around this?
Sure. I mean, I think that the simplest way to do it would say that the Fed said, we'll buy anything at any price for as long as it takes so that investors can be calm and not panic. And that was unconditional and limitless and forever. Congress said, and you just by merely saying that without even spending a dime, although they've spent a little bit, but much, much less than they have in their holster. Just by merely saying that, the markets roared back, and they know now that they have insurance. It's basically like you can now grill on your roof to your heart's content because you know if your house burns down, the government's going to come and build you a new house, a fancier house. Mm-hmm. You can do anything you want in your house now because you know that they're going to come and build it back up again. Okay. But Congress did not, Congress, as Dave just said, outsourced all of the help to corporations, which are, and the Fed, we should really underscore, most assets are owned by wealthy people in this country, and the wealthiest own the most assets. So when you're helping assets and not helping workers, you're helping the wealthiest more than you're helping the average American. Congress did help the average American in an extraordinary way, but all of that help was not up to the cataclysm that we're facing. It doesn't remotely come to, it's not commensurate with the pain and loss that average Americans are feeling right now. And it's going to run out. It's temporary. So the Fed said everything is unlimited, and we're going to do it until, we'll do whatever it takes for as long as it takes. And Congress said, we have a lot of conditions. We're going to give you some money to tide you over, and then it's going to run out. And that's it in the nutshell.
Thank you for that. Leslie has a couple questions. What happens if the company goes bankrupt? Does the government guarantee the value by printing more money? Who loses?
Well, under the current format, because these are private markets, bankruptcy would affect the private creditors. The way that the CARES Act was structured is that the $454 billion that was appropriated to the Treasury as sort of the capital base for these credit facilities was intended for losses, you call it loss absorption. So if there's a bankruptcy that, you only get paid back a portion of those bonds, and the Fed bought the bonds, then the losses are supposed to be taken up through that pot, that $454 billion pot. So it's not really money printing because the money's already been sort of printed or at least appropriated through the Treasury Department.
All right. Thank you for the question, Leslie. We don't have time to talk about this New York Times piece, but we do have it on our website, and it is related to our discussion today. According to their analysis, 60 of the country's largest hospital chains received a total of more than $15 billion with a B, in emergency funds through the CARES Act. They doled out $874 million to top executives. Meanwhile, at least 36 of those chains have laid off, furloughed, or reduced the pay of employees. So a lot of people are hurting right now. There's some data out there about how a lot of people probably will not get their jobs back. We just really don't know what's coming. I mean, as you said, Jesse, at least 100,000 small businesses have already gone under. So we have a question from Art. What will it take to change this travesty of our federal government catering, giving massive amounts of money once again to the 1%, as they did for the banks during the Great Recession, and leaving the rest of us, the 99%, twisting in the wind? We see how effective being in the streets has been in changing public attitudes towards racism and policing. Maybe our best strategy is to get in the streets. Or how about a wealth tax to transfer massive wealth from the 1% to the 99%. After all, 75 billionaires live in San Francisco. David, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, I think that if you look at this dichotomy of millions and millions of people out of work and the stock market going on a run that is unparalleled in close to 100 years, I mean, there was this graphic that on CNBC with Jim Cramer, where behind him it says best week for stocks since 1938, and underneath him it says millions of people file for unemployment. And that dichotomy really historically leads to social unrest. When you have that level, that widening gap of a rescue for a certain group of elites, and nothing or something temporary or inadequate for everybody else, you're going to see social unrest. I don't think you can disassociate the protests that are happening right now from the pandemic. I think it's all sort of a piece. And so, you know, we'll see if Congress gets a message on this. The problem is that Congress largely is of the class that has been rescued. They are, by and large, very wealthy people. Some of them have been trading stocks during this period, as Jesse's organization has well documented. And, you know, it's that's who they listen to. That's their donors. That's the people that they support them. So it's going to take a much louder megaphone to sort of understand that this is untenable for the country to only rescue during a historic depression level event the wealthiest people among it.
David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect, author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David, thank you so much for covering this issue, and thanks for joining us as always.
All right, thank you.
Jesse Eisinger is an award-winning editor at ProPublica and author of The Chicken S Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Same to you, Jesse. Thanks for your reporting on this and shining a light on this, and thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Happy to have done it.
Thank you. And I hope you can take some time to read Jesse and David's pieces. We also have some other stories. The New York Times piece about the bailout of hospitals really needs to get more attention. So I hope you can also read that. Krista, we didn't have time to get your message, but I want to say we hear you. Chris writes in saying, can you please spend more time on labor issues? We need more coverage of these issues. Yes, we hear you. Thank you so much for writing. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and David LaTulipe for keeping our studio running. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.